Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
They want to prevent us from filming home demolitions, from the night invasions that they do to Palestinian houses, from cutting water pipes, from demolishing the schools. They don't want the international community, the people abroad, to see the truth, to see our footage. So for that, we are being targeted as Palestinian journalists and activists on the ground.
As Israeli President Isaac Herzog meets President Biden at the White House and prepares to address a joint session of Congress, we'll go to the occupied West Bank to talk to Palestinian journalist Basil Adra. On Saturday, Israeli forces handcuffed and blindfolded him, forcing him to sit in the blazing sun for hours after he refused to hand over footage of an Israeli settler attack. We'll also speak with Palestinian human rights attorney Noura Erekat. Then to labor, power, and strategy.
What happens here is important because what's happening to us is happening across all fields of labor by means of when employers make Wall Street and greed their priority and they forget about the essential contributors that make the machine run.
160,000 actors enter their fifth day on strike, joining tens of thousands of screenwriters who've been on strike since May. This all comes as UPS workers are preparing for what could be the second largest strike at a single employer in U.S. history. We'll speak with the legendary historian of the Mexican Revolution, labor organizer and professor John Womack, about how to seize and build labor power and solidarity. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has warned Russia's decision to terminate the Black Sea grain deal, which allowed for the safe export of food and fertilizer from Ukrainian ports, will lead to soaring food prices and worsening hunger across the globe. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, spoke Monday after the Kremlin said it would refuse to extend the agreement.
Ultimately, participation in these agreements is a choice. But struggling people everywhere and developing countries don't have a choice. Hundreds of millions of people face hunger and consumers are confronting a global cost of living crisis. And they will pay the price.
This comes just a week after Russia vetoed the extension of a key UN humanitarian aid delivery route from Turkey into Syria. On Monday, the UN rejected restrictions placed by the Syrian government on life-saving deliveries through the Bab al-Hawa border crossing. Syrian officials conditioned the shipments on the UN's full cooperation and coordination with Syria's government, among other rules denounced by UN officials as unacceptable. Russia's military launched an early morning drone and missile attack on the Ukrainian port city of Odessa, a day after the Kremlin walked away from the Black Sea Agreement. Ukraine's military says one person was injured by debris after it shot down all six missiles and 25 drones fired at Odessa. The attack came just hours after Russian President Putin accused Ukraine of launching what he called a cruel and senseless attack Monday on a key bridge connecting the Russian mainland to the Russian in the next Crimean Peninsula.
What has happened is yet another terrorist act by the regime in Kyiv. This crime is senseless from a military standpoint because the Crimean Bridge has not been used for military logistics for a long time. It is also cruelty because innocent civilians have been killed. Of course, there will be a response from the Russian side.
In Belarus, a large convoy of Wagner mercenary forces arrived at a military field camp Monday, the first redeployment of the mercenary group's fighters since their failed mutiny in late June. On Friday, the Belarus Ministry of Defense said Wagner troops are training some of its security forces. Tens of thousands of people in Vietnam and southern China evacuated their homes as Typhoon Talim made landfall in China's Guangdong province. The storm brought heavy winds and rain, forcing the cancellation of hundreds of trains and flights. Its arrival came as China, like much of the northern hemisphere, saw temperature records shattered by unrelenting summer heat. Here in the United States, more than 88 million people are under excessive heat warnings and advisories again today. Smoke from hundreds of Canadian wildfires is triggering unhealthy air quality alerts across New England and as far south as Atlanta, Georgia, and Birmingham, Alabama. Today, Phoenix, Arizona is forecast to record its 18th consecutive day of over 110 degrees Fahrenheit with no respite in sight. A recent study found a loss of the power grid in Phoenix during a heat wave would cause at least 12,000 deaths, with hundreds of thousands more needing treatment for heat-related illnesses. White House climate envoy John Kerry is in Beijing to reestablish discussions on the climate crisis between the U.S. and China, the world's two largest emitters of greenhouse gases. Kerry arrived in Beijing Sunday as a weather station in western China logged an all-time high temperature record of 126 degrees Fahrenheit. Kerry's visit came just days after he ruled out reparations to other countries harmed by the climate crisis. Kerry made the remark during testimony last Thursday at a House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing as he was questioned by Republican Congressmember Brian Mast of Florida.
Are you planning to commit America to climate reparations? That is to say, we have to pay some other country because they had a flood or they had a hurricane or a typhoon or a wildfire?
No, under no circumstances.
Very good. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Those remarks were condemned by climate action groups, including 350.org, which said in a statement, quote, U.S. climate envoy John Kerry's words are just the latest example of Kerry and the U.S. refusing to back up their vague claims for U.S. support in global climate progress with real substantive action, they said. A ship dispatched by the United Nations has arrived off the coast of Yemen to begin pumping over a million barrels of oil from a decaying supertanker anchored in the Red Sea. The ship was abandoned off the coast of Yemen in 2015 at the start of the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war against Houthi rebels. It contains four times the amount of oil spilled off the coast of Alaska during 1989's Exxon Valdez disaster. On Monday, UN Humanitarian Coordinator David Gressley said engineers had secured the rusting ship against a potential catastrophic spill or explosion.
The structure of the FSO Safir, even though it is a decaying vessel, the hull is still very secure, which means that the transfer of the oil will be relatively low risk.
In Iowa, abortions at up to 20 weeks of pregnancy are once again legal after a district judge put Iowa's strict six-week abortion ban on hold. Polk County Judge Joseph Seidlin said Monday Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and other plaintiffs are likely to succeed on the merits of their lawsuit, which contends the bill signed by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds Friday violates Iowa's constitution. 14 states currently have abortion bans in effect after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade last summer. Here in New York, pressure is mounting for the federal government to take over the troubled Rikers Island jail complex. Manhattan U.S. Attorney Damian Williams Monday said the crisis at Rikers is, quote, a collective failure with deep roots spanning multiple mayoral administrations. 8 years ago, New York City agreed to a multimillion dollar effort to reform Rikers, but conditions have only worsened, leading to the deaths of several prisoners and growing reports of brutal violence and inhumane treatment. Meanwhile, Mayor Eric Adams has appointed new leadership to the New York Police Department. Edward Caban will be the first Latino to serve as NYPD commissioner. His rise to power comes after the abrupt departure of the former commissioner, Ke'Chan Sewell, who was the first Black woman in the role. Caban spoke alongside Mayor Adams at City Hall Monday.
Now, it's not lost on me that today's announcement is also a first, given how many great leaders of Hispanic descent have come before me in the NYPD. To be the first Hispanic police commissioner is an honor of the highest measure.
In medical news, an experimental new drug called donanemab has slowed the progression of Alzheimer's disease in patients by about 35% when used in the early stages of the disease. That makes the drug at least as effective as Leqembi, another monoclonal antibody treatment against Alzheimer's that won FDA approval earlier this month. Drug maker Eli Lilly hasn't said how much donanemab will cost if it wins regulatory approval, but a year's treatment of Leqembi has been priced at more than 26 $6,000 in the United States. Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been condemned for racist and anti-Semitic remarks after he said COVID-19 was targeted to certain ethnicities. RFK Jr. was making the comments while speaking at a dinner in Manhattan last week. A recording was published by the New York Post.
COVID-19 is targeted to attack Caucasians and black people. The people who are most immune are Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese.
The people who are most immune are Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said. On Monday, his sister, Carrie Kennedy, who heads the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Organization, strongly condemned what she called her brother's deplorable and untruthful remarks. She said, quote, "His statements do not represent what I believe or what Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights stand for. With our 50-plus year track record of protecting rights and standing against racism and all forms of discrimination." Unquote. Rolling Stone reports that RFK Jr., who's running for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, has been raking in cash from dozens of major Republican donors. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin has fueled speculation he will run as a third-party candidate in the 2024 presidential election. Manchin appeared alongside Republican former Utah Governor John Huntsman at an event in New Hampshire Monday, arguing U.S. voters are frustrated by the growing divide between the two major political parties.
I'm not here running for president tonight. I'm not. I'm here trying to basically save the nation.
Senator Manchin is the biggest recipient of fossil fuel money in Congress. Monday's event was organized by the billionaire-backed organization No Labels, which is exploring whether to run a third-party candidate for president. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee wrote on social media, quote, "No Labels is nothing more than a Republican front group. They're staffed by Republicans, bankrolled by Republicans, and their third-party gambit will only help elect MAGA Republicans like Trump. Joe Manchin just gives them the patina of bipartisanship," they said. The shipping giant UPS has begun training non-union employees to fill in for unionized workers after the Teamsters voted to authorize a strike over stalled contract talks. Unless there's a breakthrough, some 340,000 UPS workers could be on picket lines as soon as August 1st. Over the weekend, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez joined other New York lawmakers at a Teamsters rally, pledging support for what could become the largest single employer strike in U.S. history.
What we are about to step into requires solidarity from everybody, everybody across the city, across this country, across politics, across union, across workers, because your fight right here is about being the tip of the spear for dignity for every worker in this country, every worker in this country.
Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the legendary historian of the Mexican Revolution and labor organizer, Professor John Womack Jr., about building labor power and solidarity. And the Reverend Jesse Jackson stepping down as president of the Rainbow Push Coalition, the civil rights group he founded in 1996. Reverend Jackson's legacy of activism was honored at the coalition's annual convention in Chicago over the weekend with Vice President Kamala Harris and other prominent Democrats in attendance. In her remarks, Harris described Jackson as, quote, "one of America's greatest patriots, someone who deeply believes in the promise of our country," unquote. The Rainbow Push Coalition will now be headed by the Reverend Frederick Douglass Haynes III. He spoke at the event Sunday.
The Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, Sr. I stand here on his shoulders because no one with sense would try to stand in his shoes. His shoes are too large.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to the occupied West Bank as Israeli President Isaac Herzog is in Washington to meet President Biden and address a joint session of Congress. Back in 30 seconds.
من يوم ما وعيت وأنا بنت هاي البلاد بكاء أطفال وبسمة أولاد الأرض صبها أسود خيم علينا حداد عداد بطلنا نعد أحياء صرنا نعد أموات وأنا بقول بكفي عاد بدي أمسك قدري بكفي بكفي عاد فمي ومش فمي
by Mesa Dahl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Biden's meeting Israeli President Isaac Herzog at the White House today. On Wednesday, Herzog will address a joint session of Congress, though several progressive Democrats have announced plans to boycott his speech. The group includes Congress members Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, and Jamal Bowman. Cori Bush wrote, "The Israeli government's responsible for enforcing an apartheid state and rampantly abusing the rights of Palestinians. Congress should not be giving a platform to the president of a country that shows no respect for human rights. I will not be attending his joint address," unquote. On Monday, President Biden spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and invited him for a meeting in the United States this year. Biden recently criticized the makeup of Netanyahu's far-right cabinet, describing it as, quote, one of the most extremist he's ever seen in Israel. Israeli President Herzog's visit to the White House comes just weeks after the Israeli military attacked the Jenin refugee camp, killing at least 12 Palestinians in Israel's largest military operation in the occupied West Bank in 20 years. We begin today's show with Noura Erekat. She's a Palestinian human rights attorney and associate professor at Rutgers University. She's author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Let's begin with Herzog's visit, the Israeli president to Biden, the address, joint session of Congress. And then yesterday, President Biden speaking personally on the phone with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, inviting him to the United States. Your response, Noura Erekat.
So let's just begin by setting up the context that this is 2023 in the aftermath of the legacy human rights organizations, Israeli human rights organizations, UN committees, UN agencies, as well as multiple scholars and independent investigations have all concluded that Israel oversees an apartheid regime. This is also in a context where, since the collapse of the peace process in 2000, Israel has made clear that there will be no Palestinian state. There will be no such thing as binationalism, that they will catalyze and enhance their takeover of Palestinian lands and their removal. They have shifted from occupation to warfare. This is a completely different universe than the one existed in 2000. And yet the rhetoric and the feedback surrounding Isaac Herzog's invitation and speech is one that completely ignores all of that. So it's important to emphasize that this effort within Congress, specifically among a mainstream Democratic element, is meant to normalize apartheid. It's not just saying that they want to defend Israel. They are saying that if this is in fact apartheid, as all of these luminaries and experts have concluded, then in this case, it's okay, it should be an exception, and it should be exemplary for others to follow. And so I applaud the progressive members of Congress who are skipping this address. I encourage other members of Congress to do the same and continue to build the momentum amongst a progressive base that sees Palestine squarely within a social justice agenda. This is already manifest in social justice movements, such as Black Palestinian Transnational Solidarity, that has centered that this is a joint struggle, that has endorsed BDS, and that in fact catapulted many of these progressive Democrats into office. This is also evident amongst the Democrats themselves. Not only has Israel become a bipartisan issue, but for the first time ever, more Democrats sympathize with Palestinians than they do with Israelis, according to a 2023 Gallup poll. Continue to build that momentum. Resist this movement to normalize apartheid. What the members of Congress are doing with the invitation, what they did in response to Representative Jayapal's very accurate statements that Israel is a racist state, is akin to gaslighting, for lack of a better word, but really is normalization that is responding to the fact that they have lost the battle on the grassroots level and are trying to stem from the top down what they couldn't defeat from the bottom up. And we see this not only in this normalization, but we also see it in the passage of anti-BDS resolutions, as well as the adoption of the Israel Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition that wants to equate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
Nora, I wanted to play the clip you were just referring to the Progressive Caucus Chair, Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, who made headlines this weekend after she called Israel a racist state while speaking at the Netroots Nation conference in Chicago Saturday.
I want you to know that we have been fighting to make it clear that Israel is a racist state, that the Palestinian people deserve self-determination and autonomy, that the dream of a two-state solution is slipping away from us.
After facing criticism, Congressmember Jayapal later clarified her comments, writing, quote, "I do not believe the idea of Israel as a nation is racist. I do, however, believe that Netanyahu's extreme right-wing government has engaged in discriminatory and outright racist policies, and that there are extreme racists driving that policy within the leadership of the current government. We know that the status quo is unacceptable, untenable, and unjust," Pramila Jayapal said. Your response to that, Nora Ericott?
One, I want to point out that nothing that she said was controversial. If Representative Jayapal is wrong, then so are all the experts and the advocates that study this issue and that apply it across the globe. So the attack on her is actually a bullying and harassment attack that is meant to scare everyone else from even having a conversation and acknowledging this reality on the ground, and most importantly, taking responsibility for it. The United States is not just a bystander here. The United States is complicit and a pillar of Israeli apartheid in its provision on unequivocal financial, diplomatic, and military support. That, but for that support, Israel could not sustain this regime, which is not surprising. Which is not surprising at all, because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it, during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern. As to the way that Representative Jayapal amended her statement, note that she didn't walk it back. She didn't say that Israel is a racist state. She wanted to make a distinction between Israeli people and the Israeli government. But what we need to understand here, and this is important for the audience to know, that she used the term Israeli nation. And there is no such thing as an Israeli national within Israel's law. And this is the crux of the matter. Israel bifurcates Jewish nationality from Israeli citizens so that it can flow all of the possessory rights to land, to employment, to housing, to the right to life through Jewish nationality in a way that it's extraterritorialized. So that a pubescent Jewish teen who doesn't even know where Israel is on the map ostensibly has more claims than a Palestinian grandma who is 80 years old, who was born before the state of Israel was established in 1948, has to those rights. Under any situation, we would decry the system as being discriminatory, contravening liberal norms of democracy. But in this situation, the international community, specifically the United States and Western governments, want to insist that this exception is acceptable and exemplary. And what I want to emphasize is that it actually is not just harmful to Palestinians, as evidenced by the systematic killing of Palestinians, the removal and the harm inflicted upon them, but that these ideas are not contained just to Israel, Palestine, but in fact are exported. These ideas of what sovereignty should look like are exported across the world. We see it embodied by the Hindutva movement in India and its reigning government. We also see it embodied even in the United States by European supremacists such as Richard Spencer, who says that he envisions that the future of European sovereignty should be modeled upon Israel's model of sovereignty. These ideas are dangerous. And it's not that we want to make an exception here. We want to actually make it clear that there should be no situation where states are not states that belong to everybody who is there, and rather than to a nationality that exists extraterritorially.
And Nora Ericott, I wanted to ask you, the President Biden's announcement that he has invited a Prime Minister Netanyahu to also to visit the United States after months of saying that he had no plans to do so, especially in light of the enormous settlement expansion that the Netanyahu government has been involved in. I think the watchdog group Peace Now has said that 12,800 settlements across the West Bank been established since January by the Netanyahu government. Your response to this, the Biden presidency just saying, well, we're inviting Netanyahu to come to the U.S. again.
Listen, the 13,000 some settlements are just the tip of the iceberg. Israel has actually transferred authority of the West Bank from military supervision to civilian oversight. They've basically taken the fig leaf off, that this is not a temporary situation, but that this is a permanent condition and they're planning for annexation. This contravenes the diplomatic consensus on the two-state solution, which is fraught on its own. But even more than that, this contravenes even the U.S. and this U.S. administration, specifically the Biden administration. They didn't want to invite Netanyahu, not just because of his contravention and violations against Palestinians. I think that that would be quite ambitious on our part. But in fact, it was Netanyahu who undermined a sitting president in trying to establish Iranian rapprochement. It was Netanyahu who came to Congress to address a joint session to actually torpedo President Obama's attempt to establish an Iran nuclear agreement and received several standing ovations. This is the Biden administration's legacy. So the fact that not only has this been overturned, but now they're going to invite Netanyahu nevertheless without stepping back any of those missteps, any of that betrayal, is an about face and says a lot about the Democratic administration and where Israel fits, where in as far as the United States is concerned, they've thrown up their hands that they will continue to provide unequivocal support and place absolutely no conditions on Israel's behavior, on Israel's participation, even in furtherance of the U.S.'s national interests in the region.
In addition to human rights lawyer Noura Erekat, we're joined in the occupied West Bank by the Palestinian journalist Bassel Adra, who writes for 972. He spent years documenting Israeli efforts to evict Palestinians living in Masafriyata, south of Hebron. He wrote the new cover story for The Nation magazine, headlined, "The destruction of this Palestinian community was green-lighted by Israel's Supreme Court." On Saturday, he was detained while covering an Israeli settler attack at Masafriyata. After he refused to hand over his video footage, Israeli soldiers handcuffed and blindfolded him, then sat him in a chair in the blazing sun for hours. The Union of Journalists in Israel denounced Bassel's detention, describing it as a, quote, serious violation of freedom of the press. Bassel Adra joins us now from South Hebron. Bassel, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe exactly what took place on Saturday? I don't hear you if you're speaking.
Thank you. Sorry for this. On Saturday, I got a call from a Palestinian shepherd and a neighbor that the settlers invading his field. There was armed settlers and with their sheep in a Palestinian special property grazing there, as this is the recent policy of the settlers where they come over and attack Palestinians in their fields and taking of the private properties. And this is the policy of the Israeli state recently by supporting these settlers, attacking more Palestinians and taking more land and creating more new outposts and farms in Palestinian fields and the Palestinian agricultural fields. So I was filming there. Later on, arrived the police and the Israeli occupation army. They're invading houses in my village. They try to arrest people under the claim that the settlers say that their Palestinians were throwing stones at them. So soldiers went directly invading some houses, beating up people and try to arrest them. And then officer headed to me and said, "Give me your ID and your phone." And they searched my body, and he told me, you need to open your phone. I told him, this is illegal. There is a rules for this. I'm a journalist, and here my card. There is the police is just here. They didn't ask me anything for this. And he said, no, you should open your phone now and be released, or there is another long way to get the videos from you. And he didn't, say what is the long way. So minutes after that, he called like another group of soldiers who came in another jeep and asked them to take me away. So directly they took me.